Here's a mental image that might be helpful in explaining Wall Street of late. Stock traders putting their fingers in their ears, saying, la 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 la. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 20th of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a tale of two numbers and a question to follow. $200 billion is the first number. That's in dollars. The net amount of Chinese imports to this country that will be met with 10% tariffs come Monday morning if trade negotiations continue on their current path, and there is no sign they won't. 2930.75, if you want to be precise, is the second number. That was the record close on the S&P 500 today. The question that we posed to Marketplace's Justin Ho at our news meeting this morning was, how does one reconcile a trade war with Wall Street?
Look at the strong job market, rising corporate profits, GDP growth. Almost every part of the economy is doing pretty well, says Jamie Cox at the Harris Financial Group.
If you take the trade situation and set it aside for a second, you could see an easy case for the market to be where it is.
One reason investors are looking past the trade war, Cox says, is because tariffs haven't bitten into big companies like Apple, companies that make up the big indexes. But the trade conflict could be more dangerous for the rest of the world, says Jeffrey Cleveland at Payton & Riegel.
You know, most other markets that I'm looking at on my screens right now are red year to date.
The Shanghai stock market is down nearly 20% for the year. Markets in Germany and the UK are down too. Just this morning, the International Monetary Fund warned that the tariff conflict with China could have significant economic costs to the global economy.
You could make that argument that the way investors are dealing with this is by preferring U.S. and shunning the rest of the world.
Hillary Kramer at TurboTrader says the tariff dispute hasn't had a big impact in the U.S. just yet. But the longer it lasts, the more likely it is that the economy will start feeling the pinch.
Supplies will rise in price, which means that end products will have to be more expensive.
She says if that happens, consumers will feel those higher prices and jobs will be lost. Then, she says, markets will have to start paying attention. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
All right, so in my own defense here for a second, I just want to point out that I dispensed with the usual the stock market is not the economy caveat because I figured y'all knew that by now. All right, so anyway, so to contextualize those new tariffs on the $200 billion worth of Chinese imports American consumers will be paying come Monday, that's import taxes dollar-wise on just about half of everything we import from Beijing. And there are corresponding, although not quite as far-reaching, Chinese tariffs on American goods going over there. All through this season of trade disputes, Chinese manufacturers have told our correspondent in Shanghai, Jennifer Pak, that they are optimistic everything is going to be worked out pretty soon. But still? Here's Jennifer from a trade fair in Shanghai.
Thousands of booths display shiny industrial robots at the Shanghai Industry Fair. Many companies here are upbeat, including EMC Machinery, which makes machine parts used to produce cell phones and automobiles. Su Niansheng is the general manager.
Right now, we mainly export to Europe and the U.S., but next year, China will become our biggest market.
This may be why he's not that worried about the U.S. imposing a 25% tariff on some of his products since July. He says sales to the American market have been sliding, even before the tariff, because he says U.S. factories are not as competitive and do not need to upgrade to his products.
Our sales to the U.S. will likely shrink by almost half this year, to less than 10%.
Other suppliers that don't have products on tariff lists in either the U.S. or China can still be affected. Mega Robo needs American chipsets to make its intelligent robots for hospitals and research labs. These are not subject to any Chinese tariffs, but co-founder Qiao Zhixin says the chipsets now cost him 10% more. He believes his supplier in China is selling other items that are affected by tariffs and has raised all product prices to cover any profit loss. Qiao Zhixin says he can't substitute American chipsets.
It is impossible to replace all American parts. The whole world is closely connected. It's the same for the U.S. Can their firms avoid using China products? America's economy cannot develop without the help of China.
Other companies, like the Danish firm called Mobile Industrial Robots, are also caught in between. The firm manufactures in Denmark and counts the U.S. and China as its biggest markets. CEO Thomas Visti says there's no effect on his firm, but
we don't know how it will affect our customers, since our customers is electronic manufacturers and automotive also. So it could be that, you know, if they go down in volume, probably also we would have some kind of effect, but indirect.
He says he's optimistic that the trade dispute will be resolved soon, because he says the current tit-for-tat tariffs just don't make much business sense. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
As I was saying, on Wall Street today, records, don't you know? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Right Honorable Theresa May, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, is abroad today in Salzburg, Austria, for meetings with other European Union leaders who will, come March 29th next, be the Prime Minister's former colleagues in the EU once Brexit actually gets done on that deadline day. May's trying to catch a break, honestly, on the terms of Britain's departure from the EU, because back home, opposition seems to be growing amid near daily reports of the dire consequences of leaving the European Union without the right kind of trade deal, fears of gridlock at the ports and food and medical shortages. Brexit supporters, though, say frictionless trade with the EU is absolutely possible post-Brexit. They point to the port of Felixstowe on the east coast of England, whence Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
This is Britain's biggest and busiest container port. Around the clock, giant gantry cranes are at work on the dockside, lifting the steel boxes off the ships and dropping them onto the waiting trailers. $100 billion worth of goods flow in and out of this port every year, from and to the rest of the world. And yet there's not a single customs official in sight.
92% of all containers being landed are customs cleared before they actually hit dry land. The customs cleared on the vessel and they come in.
Steve Lamb of Maritime Cargo Processing. He's on the other side of Felixstowe in a converted chapel. The hush is almost church-like as he and a handful of staff sit at computer terminals, transferring data between the port, customs, police, freight and transportation companies.
It is entirely digital, works seamlessly, and as you can hear, it works perfectly because there's no phones going, there's no noise. Everything works like a Swiss watch.
Customs can assess the cargoes and levy their duties electronically before docking. Police and other authorities can take a look too. As a result, only a tiny fraction of the containers are stopped and opened for inspection at the port. There is, says Jason Flower of the Port Users Association, rarely any delay.
Cargo is automatically cleared, and as soon as a container lands, it can be on its way.
And he says, in principle and with planning, British ports should not clog up after Brexit.
If there's a computer system in place, for example, the same as the computer system in Felixstowe, and the paperwork can go into that system as efficiently as it does into Felixstowe, then it will just flow.
Member of the European Parliament for this area and staunch Brexiter David Campbell-Bannerman says that Felixstowe proves his point. The predictions of 30-mile traffic jams at the ports causing food and medical shortages are ridiculous fear-mongering, akin to the Y2K computer scare at the turn of the century.
It's a bit like the Millennium Bug, all of this. They said the planes would fall out of the sky at, you know, the stroke of midnight then. It's not going to happen. Heaven's sake, most of the trade, as Felix so well shows, you know, coming from outside the EU, is handled very efficiently and very effectively.
But those who want to stay in the EU, Remainers, point to a different port in response. 60 miles to the south, a ferry edges through the fog into the port of Dover. Most of the food arriving from continental Europe into Britain comes via this route, by truck, not container. While Britain remains in the EU, this traffic flows freely without customs declarations. The Felixstowe model just wouldn't work here, says pro-Remain commentator Jonathan Liss. The ferry crossing from France to Dover is too short for full electronic customs clearance while sailing. And there isn't the space at the port for even a small percentage of the trucks to park for inspection.
We used to have gridlock, and then supermarkets wouldn't get their food, companies wouldn't get the goods that they need for their just-in-time manufacturing. So Dover, you cannot possibly compare Dover with Felixstowe.
Back in Felixstowe, Steve Lamb is unashamedly upbeat about Brexit. His company is now working on a cargo handling system designed specifically for Dover.
I believe every challenge presents an opportunity. I've got many friends in the freight forwarding business, and some who voted Remain, but they have embraced the challenge ahead, and they're confident that they will thrive through the other side of this.
Most of Felixstowe's trade is with countries outside the EU, so this port is perhaps, understandably, more relaxed about leaving the bloc. In Felixstowe, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And American makes four this afternoon. American Airlines joined Delta, United, and JetBlue in bumping their checked bag fees. $5, $25 to $30 for the first bag, $35 to $40 for the second. And yes, sure, this is a straight-up business story. $5 times a gazillion passengers does well for a bottom line, right? But really, it's all about consumer incentives and behavioral economics. Marketplace's Renata Sago is on it.
Your extra $5 for checked bags will add up for the airlines. U.S. domestic carriers raked in $2.4 billion from baggage fees the first half of this year alone, according to the Bureau of Transportation Statistics. But for travelers with a loyalty card or airline-branded credit card, those fees can be avoided. And cards and memberships are more valuable to air carriers than baggage fees themselves. George Hobica is the founder of the travel site Airfare Watchdog. He says for travelers who want to check bags, signing up for a card
that can pay for itself in just one trip.
Eric Deckers flies Delta a few times a year. He has a Delta loyalty card and could check bags for free, but
I never check a bag. I always pack a carry-on.
He says he doesn't want to risk his bag getting lost or have to wait for it by the carousel. Travel industry analyst Henry Hardeveld with Atmosphere Research Group says he's not surprised carriers are raising checked bag fees again. Bottom line,
we can't travel naked.
And it's profitable.
It's a high margin product for the airlines to sell. And the airlines are a monkey see, monkey do business.
But when bag fees go up, he says so do travelers' expectations. They want faster bag arrival and fewer lost bags. So whether you bring it on board, pay the extra $5, or opt for a card membership, you need something to wear when you get there. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
A story now from the future of the insurance industry. John Hancock, the big life insurance company, says that starting next month, all the new insurance policies it writes are going to have a thing where policyholders can get a discount on their premiums if they agree to wear a fitness tracker. It's called interactive insurance. It's not entirely new. Progressive offers something similar for drivers, but that future may well be upon us, as Marketplace's Jed Kim reports.
Life insurance is one of those things you really don't want to use. Not even the people who sell it to you want you to use it. J.B. Silvers is a professor at Case Western Reserve University. He says each new policy is a bet for insurers.
And if they can change your behavior to make that last longer, then they're ahead of the game. If you buy a policy and die next year, they lose.
John Hancock is trying to tip the scales with a program that incentivizes healthier living. Participants who wear monitoring devices can get cheaper premiums or rewards for deals on things like Apple Watches or Fitbits. Brooks Tingle is the company's CEO.
We're happy to reward them for that because we know in the end, as a population of customers, they're going to live longer, and that creates value for us that we're sharing back with the customers.
He says the tech will allow John Hancock to go from interacting with customers maybe once or twice a year to about 40 times a month. That's a lot of chances to remind users not to pound donuts or sit in front of the TV all day. Some privacy advocates worry that insurers could use tracking technology to penalize policyholders for bad behavior. But Tingle says his company won't jack up premiums based on the data. Still, will tracking tech keep people healthier?
Reward programs in general can have a significant effect on people's behavior.
Yuping Lu Tompkins researches marketing at Old Dominion University. She says there is a risk, though, if the company gets hacked.
Somebody's going to know a whole lot about my daily movements, you know, when I go to bed, you know, maybe when I get up, how fast I drive. And so there's going to be a huge amount of data that's going to be capturing this.
She says privacy fears could slow how fast other insurers adopt tracking programs of their own. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up,
how to keep broadcasting houses 24/7 to a public traumatized by them.
Even reality TV had to deal with the collapse of the housing market. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, to paraphrase Justin Ho, trade war schmade war on Wall Street today, right? Dow Industrial's up 251, 0.9%, 26,656. The NASDAQ up 78, 0.9%, 8,028. S&P 500 found 22 points to the good, 0.7%, ended at 29.30. Two bellwethers for the whole trade war thing. Kai, come on. Rose. Boeing ascended 0.6%. Caterpillar closed up 0.2% today. One of the companies driving the NASDAQ today, Apple, rose 0.7%. You'll recall some of Apple's products, like its revamped wristwatch, got a tariff exclusion this week. You're listening to Marketplace. Every day you make economic decisions that affect your life, including choices that aren't obviously about money. That's why Marketplace covers business and finance from so many different angles in a way that is smart, relatable, and even kind of fun. To keep public service journalism going strong, please go to Marketplace.org today and become a Marketplace investor with a donation in any amount. And we do appreciate your support. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Let's do a little commodities guessing game, shall we? The category is things with unexpectedly high prices. So, oil? Well, U.S. light sweet crude was down today, just under $71 a barrel. Not, I think, unexpectedly high. Copper? Nope, not that either. Well off its 52-week highs, in point of fact. How about lumber? Well, it has been a bit of an off month for, as the technical description has it, random length lumber futures. But this past summer, it hit a record high, up 20% over a year earlier. That's great news for American sawmills and the mostly rural towns around them. But us being us, you had to know there's a tariff story in here as well. From Harvest Public Media, Esther Honing has it.
Dennis Long puts in 10-hour workdays, but he's not complaining. Neither are his coworkers at the only sawmill in Montrose, Colorado.
I don't think a lot of them are going to complain too much about it, especially when they see their paycheck every 2 weeks. That's always a kicker for them.
Increased demand for American softwood lumber is driving all the extra hours. The Montrose mill is on track to turn out over 90 million board feet of lumber this year, a new record.
You know, like right now, the lumber market's way up, and I have never seen it in my life. And I've been doing this since 78, working in a mill.
That's great news for this town of about 19,000 on the western slope. The mill supports about 250 jobs, and according to one estimate, pumps about $32 million into the local economy. Things are so good that sawmill owner Jim Nyman is investing millions of dollars to upgrade the place, something he wouldn't have done just a few years ago.
Well, there's a number of factors. Market's one. The consumer confidence has restored. The Canadian tariff is a big part of it.
Right now, the U.S. levies import duties, averaging 21% on lumber coming from Canada. Some experts say it's the main reason U.S. lumber producers have been able to raise prices. Others say increased demand and supply shortages play a bigger role. The levies are the result of a trade dispute with Canada that dates back to the 1980s. Nyman says it's fundamentally about who controls the lumber market in both countries.
I'm not going to kick their system. They're just two totally different systems.
The U.S. argues Canada can produce cheaper lumber in part because it harvests timber from public lands and the government determines the price. America logs mostly private lands and the lumber prices are all determined by the market. The last lumber agreement between the U.S. and Canada expired in 2015 and the countries failed to negotiate a new one. The U.S. import duties kicked in April 2017. They've been good for U.S. lumber, but Amanda Countryman, a trade expert at Colorado State University, says the duties are a drag on the economy.
The cost of protecting the U.S. lumber industry is paid for by Americans in the form of higher prices for lumber that make it more expensive to build a home.
In June, the National Home Builders Association reported that the cost of lumber added nearly $9,000 to the cost of a new single-family home. Sherry Whitbrown is with the Habitat for Humanity chapter in Greeley, Colorado, north of Denver. The group builds housing for low-income residents, and she's standing in the future kitchen of a three-bedroom house. At the moment, it's a skeleton of fresh lumber.
So as you can see, the 2x6 studs and the trusses and the sheeting.
She says lumber is typically the highest line item on her budget. And this summer, her lumber costs were about 30% higher than they were last fall.
Every penny counts. So when you see those kind of increases, we feel the pinch.
Whit Brown says a cost like this would typically be passed on to the consumer in the private sector. But in the nonprofit world, it means Habitat for Humanity can't build as many homes. In Greeley, Colorado, I'm Esther Honig for Marketplace.
Sit down on the couch, flip on the TV, and you start seeing what's on. And at some point in your trip up and down the channel guide, you're going to come across a housing show, some kind of renovation thing or a House Hunters or something like that. But think back for a second to what housing shows on TV were like before the crash. You buy them cheap, you add a little value, then flip them for a whole lot of profit. Then, of course, the real estate market collapsed and HGTV and all the rest had to figure out how to get and keep audiences in a world where people had just lost their homes. Stephen Kuritz wrote about housing reality TV of days gone by for the New York Times. Stephen, good to have you on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Take me back pre-crash, would you, to reality TV in the home flipping era. What was that like?
I think it was as exuberant as the economy was and as the housing market was at that time. I mean, there were all these shows bought and sold. Flip this house, the real deal. There was even a flip this house and a flip that house. I mean, that's how many flipper shows were on TV. And it was all about how you can use your own home or other, you know, homes that you buy cheaply, basically as a cash machine, you know, bought for this, invested sold this, and sold for that and collect the profits.
And then the good times came to an end. Did the reality TV business, housing market wise, did they pick up on it right away or was it a little lag?
They didn't really, I think, know quite what to do. I mean, you know, they faced an existential problem, which was how to keep broadcasting houses 24/7 to a public traumatized by them. It took them a couple of years to figure out a new formula. I talked to someone at HGTV, an executive there who was there at the time, and she said that some shows were scrapped mid-production because the tone didn't fit the recessionary times.
What is the new formula then, and was there a turning point, I guess, when they figured it out and the comeback in this kind of TV began?
It wasn't until DIY debuted this show called Rehab Addict in 2010 that viewers were given a new spin on the old dream of happiness through home ownership. The star of that show was a woman named Nicole Curtis, and she was a house flipper, but she was a different kind of house flipper. She restored old homes to their former glory in the upper Midwest. And so that really was the first glimpse of a new way of presenting this with the recession.
I confess to a certain amount of this kind of watching, right? I do House Hunters International, and also there's one on swimming pools that
I don't know that one.
I can't even. Yeah, I should have looked it up. Whatever it's called. So I'm kind of hate watching these, right? I mean, you know, honestly, that's kind of what I'm doing. All of which goes to this point. People still watch. I mean, HGTV still has ratings, right?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these shows are, I mean, Americans, you know, we're a home fixated country. Mm-hmm. And these shows still do well. Fixer Upper, the show that stars Chip and Joanna Gaines in Waco, Texas, they became huge celebrities on the cover of People magazine numerous times out of that show. They have a multi-million dollar brand called Magnolia, that grew, lifestyle brand that grew out of that show.
And people are still going to keep watching, right? That's the name of the game.
Yes.
This is like it's a little fantasy game. It's easy. You watch it on TV and go, oh no, pick house number two, or boy, I wouldn't pay $100,000 for that house.
Exactly. There is sort of a game show quality to it. Even with House Hunters, you know, the couple sees three houses and you're at home going, no, don't pick number two, pick number one. You know, that's all part of it. Yes. And you follow along with the drama too.
Stephen Kuritz at the New York Times. Thank you, Stephen. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, Cognitive Dissonance Edition. President Trump tweeted his irritation with OPEC today. That's the oil cartel, of course. In an early morning tweet complaining about how much the United States spends to, quote, protect the Middle East, the president said, and again, I quote, "The OPEC monopoly must get prices down now!" Exclamation point. So here's the thing. And as we told you a couple of days ago, according to the U.S. Department of Energy, that is the U.S. government, the United States is the single biggest producer of crude oil in the world. All right. Wall Street Today records, as we said. John Buckley, Eve Epstein, Stephen Gregory, John Gordon, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.